This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you in part by Best Fiends. Sponsors like Best Fiends help keep the lights on and the newsletter contributors paid, so keep an ear out for the Best Fiends spot later in the episode. And that episode starts right now.
It's always a pleasure, Harry. You look good. Put on some weight.
Fuck off.
Australia-Irish rebel icon and possible steampunk pioneer Ned Kelly gets yet another big screen treatment, but does Justin Kurzel's take on Peter Carey's novel, The True History of the Kelly Gang, do what others couldn't and hold my interest? And we won't bury the lead, the Catch and Kill podcast did not hold our interest. Is that because Ronan Farrow's book was too good, or because the book was a book? Grab a colander helmet. It's The Bladder Presents, episode 140. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, where we've tried to find the true crime that's worth your time. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and joining me from the epicenter of the epicenter is Alex Segura. Welcome back, Alex.
Thanks for having me. This is a nice change of pace.
That I'm not sure what that says, but
yeah, I don't know. You nailed it with epicenter of the epicenter. So
yeah, I think everyone can fill in the blanks there. I'm sorry that we didn't have more successful topics to talk about today. So let's get in it so we can get out of it with the most wanted section.
Yes.
Okay, so we are talking about the true history of the Kelly Gang, which may also just be called True History of the Kelly Gang. It's somewhat unclear. Here's the case file from IFC Films press materials. Quote, set amidst the grueling badlands of 19th century Australia, legendary outlaw Ned Kelly grows up under the bloody and uncompromising rule of the English. Food is scarce, survival is filled with daily strife, and every opportunity the colonizers take to make their victims feel powerless is inflicted with searing brutality. Oh, God. Speaking of searing brutality, this press release. Yeah. Easy. Okay. Continue. In a desperate attempt to prime him for rebellion, Ned Kelly's mother sells him off into the hands of the notorious bush ranger Harry Power, where the young bandit discovers he comes from a line of warriors called the Sons of Sieve. Fueled by his roots and a voracious appetite for revenge, Ned Kelly leads an anarchist army to wreak havoc on their oppressors in one of the most audacious attacks the country has ever seen. Grimy, gritty, and full of action-packed thrills, True History of the Kelly Gang brings a revolutionary twist to an iconic piece of folklore based on the novel by Peter Carey, end quote. They misspelled Russell Crowe's name in here, I just noticed. Russell Crowe,
relatively minor Australian actor.
Russell. Russell Crowe plays the notorious bush ranger. Essie Davis of the Babadook is his mother. Charlie Hunnam is one of the law enforcement blaggards. Trying to inflict searing brutality on the Kellys. I'm not sure where to start, so I will begin by saying, before I forget, the film hits digital and VOD this Friday, that's April 24th, and for our Angelino listeners, it will be playing on the big screen at the Mission Tiki 4 Drive-In in Montclair. So,
whoa.
The possible resurgence of the drive-in experience thanks to COVID is not much of a silver lining, but I'm just going to take that tiny W. All right, on to the film. How had you seen any other Ned Kelly big screen properties? Let's start there.
No, I had not. So I kind of went in with relatively blind, but it definitely doesn't hold anything back, you know, from the opening scene. I hate the cliche of it grabs you by the throat, but it definitely just pulls you into the world really fast, which I appreciated as a crime writer. And then realizing that it's based on a crime novel as opposed to like an actual history of Ned Kelly. It felt much tighter than something that was trying to hew more towards a historical fact.
Yeah, I have to agree. Having consumed many hours of Ned Kellyana in the last 48, I believe the world's first feature-length scripted film was a movie about Ned Kelly in 1906. I didn't watch that. I did watch the Mick Jagger one from 1970, which featured ballads about Ned Kelly written for this with words by Shel Silverstein, sung by Waylon Jennings. Also,
not Mick Jagger.
Also, Mick Jagger, is in it. And his Irish accent is worse than David Boreanaz's in Buffy, which is real bad.
That's saying a lot, yeah.
And I have also seen the Heath Ledger one a couple of times. Here's the issue. Heath Ledger is good in it because he's always pretty good. It made me miss him, but it still wasn't very interesting because I think Ned Kelly as a historical figure turned legend on the order of Jesse James for Americans. You have to find something new to do with what the historical record tells you. And neither of those movies does that much. They're just kind of going in an order. And, here's what sort of, here's the first injustice that sets him off. And here's the first misunderstanding with a police officer. And now there's a battle where they're wearing plow parts as armor. And now everyone's dead.
Yeah.
Not a ton of tension.
Yeah, it's a pretty linear story. And I think they do succeed in this take. And I say that as someone who has not immersed themselves in the Ned Kelly verse as much as you have, but it definitely feels much tighter and much more, there's much more suspense being built and much more narrative, which, is the benefit of having a fictionalized version of a real figure. But it also feels really modern, which is hard to do with historical fiction, especially films, because you have all these visual motifs and you have to kind of set the period piece. But it doesn't feel anachronistic in that it's too modern, but they speak in a modern way and they seem to kind of relate to each other in a modern way. And it felt, I had to kind of remind myself that this was set in the past, which could be bad, but it worked here.
Yeah, I think they did this. One review I read, which I'll link to in the show notes, compared it to Baz Luhrmann, trying to update it by not necessarily having period details where they should be. Everyone has these punk normcore mullets in the Kelly Gang. Yeah. And there's at one point, his mom, not Kate Kelly, that's his sister or whatever, Ma Kelly, is wearing skinny olive jeans and a boiled wool collarless jacket. And I was like, why is this?
Yeah. Yeah. It felt very hip, much hipper than I thought I would have imagined people in that period really dressed or carried themselves. But
yeah,
I think that made it palatable, I guess more. I mean, it was easier to dive in and kind of accept what was happening. But I don't know if I wasn't swept away by the story, if I wasn't as entertained by the story, swept away is a little strong. If I wasn't entertained by the story, I would have been probably nitpicking stuff like that a lot more, but I was enjoying it enough that I didn't care that it was not 1000% accurate to the time period.
I definitely don't. I didn't need it to be accurate to the time period, partly because I had just seen 4 hours worth of that. And it's we get it. Mick Jagger can't grow a beard, duly noted. Yikes.
Yeah.
But there's also, there's something about these figures who, with the passage of time and the accruing of legendary status, are they're just big stones. It's Stonehenge. That it's well, Stonehenge is impressive, but can you get 2 hours of narrative out of it? So I think this is a smart idea to kind of mess around. There's some, sign in the movie that is the Faulkner quote about the past not being past. Like, that guy wasn't even born, I don't think, when all this...
That's kind of a retcon.
Yeah. So, and then the end credits are like graffiti with the cast's name in it. And I think that you have to try to like either put some kind of crazy spin on it. Like, we're members of a secret society called the Sons of Civ, which that like everyone wears gowns to disguise themselves and cattle rustle, which sort of doesn't make any sense. But on the other hand, I think this like Malick-y elliptical take on it is the smart play, even if it doesn't entirely work out, which this did not entirely work for me.
No, it didn't work 100%, but it felt like, I will always give credit when someone just shoots towards being weird over just towing the line and just doing a kind of Wikipedia film bio, which it sounds like a lot of them are just, hewing so closely to the facts. I like that the director chose to kind of weird things up and give it some kind of personality that it wouldn't have if he was really strictly sticking to history. But then, like you said, there were some choices that just didn't work.
For one thing, it's 2 hours and 5 minutes, and there are several sequences that are labored, and I think he probably could have lost 10 or 15 minutes from the total runtime and had it really feel like a tight, more, it just would have felt more assured. Certainly once the director settles into it, and this director, Kurzel, also made a well-regarded movie about the Snowtown murders. I think it's just called Snowtown. John Bunting, no relation. And he sort of...
It also felt like he was a kid for too long. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
But oh, yeah. No, go ahead.
It just felt like, okay, is this movie just like little Ned Kelly? Like, it's just really like, it spent a long time with him as a child. And I felt like some of the vignettes or some of like the minor plot points could have been skipped over. I agree. It ran too long and it could have been a lot more compact, and it would have gotten you to kind of peak Ned Kelly much faster. And that's kind of what you want.
Yeah.
Alpha Ned.
Yeah. Alpha Ned. Although, Alpha or like, I don't know, Ned Prime.
Yeah.
Mini
Little Ned.
Nedlet.
Yeah.
All the acting is quite good. This, Little Ned is played by a guy named Orlando Schwert, which amazing. What a name. That's a name and a half. Yeah. And
that's great.
He's really good. Grown Ned is really good. Ma Kelly is Essie Davis. She's amazing. I'm going to play a clip from, like in the first, I'm going to say half hour, some of the writing is really garbageville because I think the director and the screenwriter are trying to let you know that they do know the myth, and it's like they're bona fides and it's not necessary. The actors almost get by with it, but not quite. Clip two.
Yeah. Hang on.
You may be able to live without seeing your boy every other day, but family means more to me than that.
I was merely trying
to... I know what you're trying to do. The English have been doing it ever since you dragged us here. Trying to bleed our culture out like you did the black fella before us. Thank you. But I just as soon teach my son a lesson in family loyalty than any from your fancy books.
Writers... Don't make your characters say the phrase your fancy books or your fancy book learning or anything like it. It's burnt. Don't do that.
Yeah, definitely early on, especially before Nedlet is sold away. It's you could tell they were still feeling their way through in terms of just dialogue, and especially Ma Kelly. She has a lot of intense scenes that the dialogue doesn't really land. That one sequence where she's arguing with Pa Kelly before he gets, he goes away. Just felt a little too heavy-handed, a little too forced, and a little too default, you know, language wise.
Yeah, I'd agree. There's also, you know, they sort of plant the seeds of the idea that that Pa Kelly is experimenting with gender or is possibly trans.
Right.
And then they sell that out later in a way that makes me think they want to split the difference and get like more socially conservative tradition, like Ned Kelly, traditionalist truther Australians, not to hate the movie or something.
Yeah. Like obsessive Ned Kelly people.
Yeah, I guess. And I have no trouble imagining that this type of person exists, because the story of how many times Ned Kelly's remains have been stolen from various institutions, that is like a three-part Netflix series on its own, and I would absolutely watch the shit out of it.
It just seemed like they were trying to have their cake and eat it too, to seem like they were being very socially progressive but also cater to the like we said, the Ned Kelly obsessives, which it just didn't wash. It just felt like you can't please everyone. I would have preferred that they just went all in and you know, stretched it out. It isn't meant to be a historically accurate take. So then take liberties and, you know, use the tools that drama gives you.
Yeah. Or have them be the daughters of Civ, or be like, you know, Pa Kelly joined this secret society because he wanted to, you know, feel at home in his whatever, like wherever he was on the gender or no gender spectrum. That just made me a little sad because there's this moment when, like, when you first meet Alpha Ned, he's just gotten out of prison and he's kind of like wrestling around on a train with his friend from jail. And the nature of their relationship is kind of not really explained. Like it's implied that they're doing it, but it's also like not a big deal to them or the film that that's true. So why not just live in the ambiguity since y'all brought it up? I don't know. It's just disappointing.
Yeah, I would have appreciated that more because that felt more genuine and organic. Like this is happening. You know, we don't have to over explain it. Just kind of draw your own conclusions or, you know, take it for what it is. But instead of having that little like end note to disqualify everything.
Yeah. I mean, let's just jump ahead to the end note where where his brother Dan Kelly, who was played by Nick Cave's kid, while wearing a ton of rings and just having normal modern tattoos, like again,
yeah,
this ambiguity is fine, but like the movie never seems entirely comfortable in it, which is a pity. But here he is not really explaining how the Sons of Civ work.
Who are the Sons of Civ?
We're rebels. Flies in the ointment of the English. Bandits. Warriors.
And you're one?
Yeah. Me and my friends.
And you all wear dresses?
Not dresses. They're masks. I've been dressing like this nun for years. Scares the fucking bejesus out of the English. Men are most afraid of what they don't understand. Not a rifle. Not a blade. And if you wear a frock to a fight, I'll think you're crazy. Nothing scares a man like crazy.
Okay, like whatever you say,
It also feels like such a weird tonal shift to throw in right at the end when the rest of the movie is so not that. It's so about just presenting things and letting the viewer draw their own conclusion, which to me is the best kind of art, I guess. You know, you let people react to it and you don't have to over explain it. This feels like notes you got in a meeting from the studio and then had to go back and reshoot, which I have no knowledge of whether that happened, but it just felt like we have to explain why this is because we're getting pressure about that.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. And it goes back to what I was saying before, that it's this like hedge against like accusations of being too something. I don't know. Like, it's like the studio was like, well, let's just, you know,
I need to explain this. Yeah.
Yeah, let's just make it clear that this is all sort of a ruse for the purposes of stealing livestock. Like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, and are dresses really that scary? Like, is it some kind of weird phobia that we're not aware of, like outside of this world?
Yeah. Also, from the standpoint of sneaking around in the darkness, trying to make off with other people's cows, it does seem like perhaps bright red silk is not the play.
Yeah, it's a little counterintuitive if you want to stay off the grid.
Yeah. Like, I'm not a cattle rustler, so what I don't know is a lot, but...
Not a ton of bushranger experience.
Yeah. Oh, sure. That's what they all say. I was impressed by the performances, and yet I was like, these performances and this idea, like, they just needed to sort of, like, tear it all down and start over from a more confident... a better paced place that just sort of like nodded at the studio notes and then ignored them. But
it's definitely 2 out of 3 for me. I mean, it's the acting is, like you said, the acting is great. And the direction, like there's clearly a visual style, which I always appreciate with a movie, but the story, it just didn't live up to the other two, which is a shame. Just having that kind of like rosy bow tie, you know, like a ribbon tying ending is just, you know, the whole movie is about gray areas and just not clear about things. And it's, even though it is this one guy's story, but then to try and tie it all up together that way feels bizarre. And there's just clunky dialogue and scenes run too long. And it just could have taken another pass, I guess. And it's a shame because the other two parts of it are so great. You know, even Russell Crowe, like, hamming it up is great.
Yeah, he's really, I mean, he's clearly having a good time. And it does try something. Like, it doesn't quite, it stumbles as it's trying to do it, and it doesn't do it quite quickly enough. But there are moments where you really feel like this is something that you don't always see. Like the last scene when Ned Kelly is hanged, like they don't, it's not that like cinematically neat hanging. It, like, he's squirming around and suffering at the end of the rope for longer than you would normally see in this kind of narrative, which I thought was appropriate. And despite some not just clunky dialogue, but dialogue that from scene to scene can't quite seem to decide how it feels about Ma Kelly and if she's, you know, like victim of circumstance or she's like stealth heroine trying to take care of her family, or if she's like
some Lady Macbeth vibes too. Like,
just that it's like, do you, the movie, like her or not? Like, pick a side or don't.
Please decide.
Yeah, decide. Also, please get Essie Davis a comb. Like, she's wearing like a Chanel jacket, but like dreadlocks are starting to happen. Like, when are we supposed to be? But I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, she's got her like Outback Chic thing going very well, aside from her hair.
Yeah, but it's like even a very poor family would, like, she would contrive some way to comb her hair and tie it off her face. I feel. But speaking of luxurious hair, back to Russell Crowe.
Yes.
Long hair, full beard, and contractually required singing moment.
Yes.
Let's hear clip 3 else. And him entertaining the kids by sneaking curse words into a folk song.
Oh, man.
Fuck you, curiosity, convicted, sent to heaven on earth for my sins. I want to start fresh and have no regrets. There's one in each town who won't let you forget. Our soldiers ain't as bad as our coppers. Our soldiers will earn their pay. But a trap's gonna take anything you can make. He'll eat your wife's pussy. courtesy of your dinner plate. He's a constable. He's a constable. He's a constable.
I mean, he's not bad. Like the song is like goofy and it's for, you know, fourth grade boys. That's fine.
Yeah.
I laughed. But it's overall, I can't exactly recommend this movie at this length. But I would also like to hear from Australians who sort of come up with this personage. Like maybe it doesn't loom that large. Maybe every now and then the studio system is like, well, it's been a while since the last Ned Kelly movie. Let's try this.
It's like their big franchise.
I don't have any idea where he actually like is in the pop culture firmament of topics. So Australian listeners, please let us know about that. And if you have seen this, because I think it came out, it was at film festivals last year and was out in Australia already. So,
oh, okay.
Your thoughts where, you know, Yanks should put this in perspective. I would love to hear about it. And also if there is a documentary series about all the people who have stolen parts of Ned Kelly's skull over the years, like I said, I'm here for it.
I did very much enjoy Grimy Santa Russell Crowe. That was a highlight.
Grimy Santa. I wonder if he's just at a point in his career where he's like, he does like two things a year and he just is going to have the maximum amount of fun.
Yeah, I mean, he's earned it. Good for him.
Yeah.
Ride it out.
Yeah. Everyone is quite good. Charlie Hunnam is convincingly repellent in his role. Like with the Ned Kelly of 2003, this is like the who's who of Aussie talent. So, I mean, I don't know. If you have a VOD credit, check it out. I can't really tell anyone to pay for it, but if you happen across it, if it comes to like Showtime or HBO, check it out.
Yeah, if it's around.
Yeah. Anything else on this before we move on to the cold case section?
Nope.
All right. Before we do that, a word from our sponsor, Best Fiends. I love talking and thinking about true crime, clearly, but even I need a break from it now and then. And for the past couple of months, my go-to mental palate cleanser has been Best Fiends. Best Fiends is a puzzle game that anyone can play. You don't need to be a hardcore gamer. But despite the adorable graphics and sound effects, it is made for adults, with puzzles challenging enough to keep you sharp and ongoing storylines. Okay, there are ongoing storylines about collecting carrots and keys and diamonds, but that's just the thing for the times in which we live, at least for me. Best Fiends is great for those in-between times when you're waiting for the microwave to finish some popcorn, or when your dog is performing an ultra-thorough inspection of hydrant number 3 on your block, talking about a friend. And if you have to quit the game in a hurry, no worries. The game remembers where you left off, and it drops you right back in. And if your internet quits in a hurry, no worries there either. You don't need Wi-Fi to play Best Fiends. You can play it anywhere, anytime. I've been playing it a lot lately to give myself a cheery distraction from the headlines. But even on days when I burn through like 15 levels, it doesn't get old, because Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends. Okay, speaking of fiends, on to the cold case. In theory, we are talking about Catch and Kill podcast with Ronan Farrow. In practice, I think we're probably going to talk more about the book because we both thought very highly of the book and the podcast struggled to hook us. Is that accurate?
Yes, I would agree. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to give you a quick case file from the podcast landing page on Apple Podcasts, just in case you're not familiar with the Catch and Kill franchise. Quote, for the past 2 years, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow has been following a trail of clues from his investigation of Harvey Weinstein to other blockbuster stories about the systems that protect powerful men accused of terrible crimes in Hollywood, Washington, and beyond. But he didn't bring that information to light on his own. A compelling cast of sources, from brave whistleblowers to shadowy undercover operatives, decided the fate of these investigations, sometimes risking everything in the process. The Catch and Kill podcast brings you their stories in their own words for the first time. I will now leave a content warning for Weinsteininess because, yeah. So I read the book last year and I reviewed it for bestevidence.fyi as the November bonus book review. I could not put the book down. And when I had to put the book down, I was thinking about it and like just turning it over in my mind and thinking about how he balanced the story and the story of the story and being in the story and how extraordinary the job was that he did. I really thought the book was amazing, difficult, but amazing.
Yeah, I couldn't put it down. And I wasn't really, I didn't really think I was in the mood to be reading that. I think I read it a couple, maybe a month and a half ago. And it was just so compelling. I was thinking about it when not reading it, and I found myself reading it very quickly, which is always a good sign. And he really does balance the, I guess, for lack of a better term, memoir aspect with the journalistic stuff, because you're invested in his story, literally, and also in his narrative, his personal connections, and how he, you know, got the rug pulled out from under him at NBC, and how he was really stuck to his guns, which was admirable. And he weaves them together pretty well. I think there's only a few moments where I felt like, okay, he's treading a little water, or I can speed through this, but I didn't. I read the whole thing pretty quickly. Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was a fantastic piece of journalism and personal essay, kind of.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think I would probably give it like 4.75 stars out of 5, just because there were a couple of like clunky bits or places where he clearly didn't know how to transition to the next section. And I kind of felt like his editor should have told him, like, look, you're Ronan Farrow. Everybody's been waiting for this book to come out. You can just put some space on the page. Like, we trust you. It's okay. You don't have to be like, he would sometimes have these little transitional, like, not jokes, but like little bits of wordplay that it was like.
Yeah, a few of the running gags didn't really land. And I think once, I hate to say it, once the wave, kind of the peak of the story happens in the book, there's a little bit of trying to get your moorings back, where he's trying to kind of figure out what the rest of the book is going to be. And he hops around, he goes to Trump, and he goes into, you know, what happened to him. And it just felt a little disjointed and not as really great as the first, I think, 3/4 of the book.
Yeah, I think that's about right. He may have been in the position, not the same as Bob Colker in Lost Girls, where it's like, you know, we don't have a, there's no ending. So how do I end this? But it kind of was that I'm sure his publisher was like, well, until there's actually like, until he gets sentenced, like we have to proceed. Something has to happen. Such minor quibbles. I really thought it was an extraordinary book. So
yeah, it was strong.
But I don't know, like I hadn't listened to the podcast because I was like, I can't imagine that it's going to, I wasn't left wanting more from the book. And right. I wasn't hearing that it was doing anything the book didn't do. And I got through the first two episodes just sort of for drill for this. And then I think that's when I got an email from you that you're like, I couldn't finish this. And I was like, oh, geez, no one was asking you to finish it. I couldn't finish it either.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I thought, you know, what I had just read the book and I was like, okay, there's more content. I thought it would be an addendum to the book, basically. And the book, like you said, feels very complete, and he does a nice job of tying it all together, even though at that point Weinstein hadn't been tried or hadn't been found guilty, and there was no like kind of period to put at the end of the sentence.
Right.
But I thought, okay, now this podcast is going to expand on the book and tell you what's happened since and really continue the book. And it really didn't feel like that. It felt like, let's have these chapters I wrote in the book told to you by the people I wrote about, but
yeah.
They don't have the same authorial voice. You know, that's what keeps the book together, is that he really ties it all together and kind of curates what people say and what quotes he uses. Whereas like you give the mic to this private eye and he's rambling on, and you just feel like, I just felt like I'd heard it before and I'd heard it better before. And it didn't add anything really. It was more like, it was felt more like behind the scenes or DVD extras, which are fine, but
yeah.
I've never been really into that kind of stuff. I'll just watch the movie, and if I have time, I'll read the extras, but it felt very additive, not very additive. It just felt like extra.
Yeah. I mean, and if it's going to be DVD extra type material, then boil away all the stuff that we already got from the book and have it just be the extras. But it's like, I mean, there are a few things going on here, and some of them are not Pharaoh's fault or Pineapple Media, I think this podcast is from. It's like not anyone's
right.
fault that, like, this came out at the end of last year. And now we, in the before time, and now we live here. Socially distanced from one another. It's a very different world. And I think that perhaps without even being conscious of it, sometimes our like standards for narratives that are working have changed.
Not
always
it's true.
Logically. There's also...
No, I was just going to say that all this kind of happened while I was between the book and the podcast. When I started reading the book, I think we had just... all this insanity had started, and we were starting to hunker down. And then by the time I finished it, we were in it. And then the podcast itself. So it's very much, could very much be as much my fault as any content in the podcast. Maybe my head just wasn't in the game. It's also really heavy stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's heavy, and there is something like every episode starts with a content warning, which is fine. But the content warning starts with a woman going like this, "Hey, like,
yeah,
you know what? Maybe just like take a breath and like, hello, Catch and Kill listeners. Just a reminder that we'll be discussing this sort of cash. So that didn't sit real well. And I think that this was not quite thought out in terms of how, first of all, one of the book's hallmarks is how elegantly he goes back and forth between parts of the story.
Right.
And that process is different on audio. It just is. I spend a lot of time thinking about this when I'm reviewing true crime books in text versus the audiobook, and how the experience can be very different. And some stories are not cut out for to be heard.
I thought it would be more seamless too, because the bulk of my reading the book was spent, you know, on walks, listening to it on audio. So I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to shift over to...
interesting.
Yeah, which is... Yeah, it was... I did that thing where, you know, the Kindle WhisperSync thing.
Oh,
where
okay.
I'm not a paid... they're not an advertiser, but it's convenient because it links your Kindle to the audiobook and you can kind of jump from one to the other. So I did read some of it as a book, but the bulk of it was listening to it, and then that's what I thought would make the transition to the podcast even more seamless.
Interesting.
It still didn't work, because I think one thing that Pharaoh does really well is he tips his hat early on. Like, there's the scene with Matt Lauer at the beginning of the book where if you're not like leads, or look, if you're a little disconnected from the news, you don't know what happened to Matt Lauer. So you read that scene and you're like, huh, I wonder what's going on here. Or the producer like crying as she's watching like a blooper reel. And so, you know, something is coming, and he's really good at that in a like suspense novelist kind of way.
Yeah.
And you don't really get that with the podcast. It's just kind of straight, hey, you were in my book. Let's talk about what I said about you in my book.
But then it's kind of trying to have it both ways, because it also doesn't know how to reorganize itself in terms of the audio. Like, each chapter, so to say, of the podcast is about a different aspect of the process. And I don't think that style of siloing each aspect away from the others quite works for this material. Let me jump back, though, for a second before I forget. Sure. Did he read it himself?
Yeah.
The book. It's his
okay.
voice. Yeah. All right. I'm going to play a clip from episode one of the podcast, because I distinctly remember this exact part of the book. And I remember thinking that he did an excellent job, not just describing the experience of trying to meet up with this black cube dude, but bringing you into his process of like settling on a way to describe it, which, as a like writing process nerd, I was looking at what he was doing from a meta standpoint a lot and thinking it was really cool. But it doesn't work at all in this context. So here's clip five.
What happened next felt like I was in a John le Carré novel or something. We agreed to meet at a Brazilian restaurant in Manhattan. But when I got there, this person didn't show. Instead, my phone rang. The caller ID said Axiom again. It was a man with what sounded like it might be a Russian accent. He told me what I was wearing and said he needed to make sure that we weren't being followed. He instructed me to leave the restaurant, walk against traffic for several blocks, and then sit down in the back of a different restaurant. That was when I first met Igor Ostrovsky, a private investigator who'd been following me, watching me, for weeks. This guy.
I didn't think I was going to be followed, but I thought you might be.
I mean, this is not uninteresting to like actually hear Igor. Like, that is a value add, I guess. But we spend like 20 minutes of the first episode on Igor's like adventures breaking up a high school credit card scam. Guys.
Yeah, that really dragged. Yeah, I didn't need his bio. In fact, I enjoyed Ronan Farrow's intro much more. That felt more like the book, which you're thinking you're getting people from the book, you know, who enjoy his way of writing or his style. And so you have that. And then Igor is like recounting his life story, which didn't work.
Yeah. Or just, I don't know, break it down even further, like you said, into DVD extras, where it's like, if you want to know more about Igor, like, here's a 12-minute episode that's like background facts or him talking about how he got into the business or whatever. Like, it just is trying to balance the book with extras, and anyone who's coming in having read and enjoyed the book doesn't need 70% of what's here. And anyone who hasn't read the book, I'm not sure is going to get as much from the extras. So I guess this just isn't for people who read the book.
Yeah, it just doesn't feel essential. And what I really wanted, which didn't seem to exist after the first two episodes, was a continuation of the book and maybe an expansion on what he couldn't cover in the book.
Yes.
So, well, you know, I understood that it would have to have some kind of ramp up information for people that don't read books, I guess, but just want to listen to the podcast, you know, some 101, like, and I can tolerate that, but then to really just, it just didn't give me anything else that I didn't have. It felt very non-essential, which it's a fine podcast. And a part of it could have also been that I was just spent on the story, but I read that book really fast and I seemed to like the book. So something didn't jibe with the podcast.
Well, yeah, I was wondering if, where we were going to come down on that in terms of, since you had just finished the book and I had several months of distance from it, if maybe you just had topic fatigue, whereas I was like, oh, like this is a lot like the book, but it's, you know, 40 to 50% new or different material. But this just felt like mostly retread. And then, all right, well, let me just play clip six, because this kind of hangs a light on the problem that we've been talking about, which is that if you have any grounding in this topic at all, like you're, if you don't, you're probably not going to listen to this, but if you do, then you've already heard this if you read the book. Anyway.
That year, I pitched a series about bad behavior in Hollywood, and for months, I got a crash course in how hard to sell the topic is. A story on pedophilia was deemed too dark. One on race was dinged because our bosses said no one would care. But I held on to a green light on one tough story I'd pitched.
Casting couch.
The casting couch. It's a euphemism in the industry. It's when powerful people seek sexual favors from newcomers trying to get a foot in the door. And that fall, the term was coming up again because of something the actress Rose McGowan had tweeted.
Who over the age of 13 does not know what a fucking casting couch is, I ask you?
Yeah, that was over-explaining. And it's the kind of thing that I feel like somebody would catch if it's in a manuscript and kind of note it and say, you know, you don't need to explain this. It feels very heavy-handed.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, in the main, this feels like someone on his publisher's team being like, look, everyone has a companion podcast and we should strike while this iron is hot, which, look, we're all trying to eat, and I'm not judging anyone for this, but...
Is that iron hot? Is that, like, I mean, I know it's a thing, but I have yet to listen to one, and I won't start rattling them off, but I've listened to a few, you know, because you have the same thing, where you love a book, and you're like, wow, there's more content. But I've yet to run into one where it's like, that was worth it. That feels additive. That feels like a lost chapter or really new info. Most of the time it just feels extra.
Yeah. Or just, you know, the publishing industry being maybe a little bit behind on how to get other media to work for its product instead of against its product. Like, I think there's like a failure to respect what podcasts do qua podcast. And it's just like, well, let's have, you know, like catch and kill, but talking. It's not exactly that simple, unfortunately.
Yeah, I wonder if the strategy is just, hey, maybe not everyone's going to want to read a book, so we can give them the book as a podcast. And that's a fine strategy.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work for me as someone who's read the book and wants more. And
also, you listen to the book, so
yeah,
like there's,
yeah, I'm fine. It's okay that I'm not the ideal customer for this because I've already read the book. So maybe the idea is they want to bring in new people, which is fine, but it just didn't feel like a cumulative thing. Like you shouldn't read the book. If you're going to, the podcast can serve as your podcast version of the book in a best case scenario, I guess.
Yeah. It's just not, like, the overlap isn't in the good way. It's like superfluous way. And the sad part is, I think that there's probably enough recorded material that Farrow used that you could have a cool, like, book extra assemblage of stuff, or make it entirely new stuff and like Ronan Farrow interviewing people. Just interviewing people about this topic generally, or about the topics that he just mentioned in the clip we just heard that got killed. Like, this isn't a guy who sucks at interviewing people. Just,
yeah, he's fantastic.
Have him do that. Everything is working against itself here, which is a pity. But in our last clip, this is the audio that Amber Gutierrez, was that her name? I think so.
Yeah.
This actor took, you know, like surreptitiously taped Weinstein. It is chilling. And then to hear this producer, McHugh, who I think on balance is like, he's a good guy, but kind of was in a little bit of male privilege until hearing some of the materials that Ronan Farrow was getting.
Right.
This clip, I was like, all right, if you have more stuff like this, as skin crawlingly hard as it is to listen to, like, this is what we're talking about here. Like, this is the predator caught on tape, and this has something else to tell us that wasn't that the book couldn't, because you couldn't actually hear this,
the clip, yeah.
You know, human shit pile trying to assault this woman again. Anyway, here is clip 7. And as always, take care for yourselves, listeners. If you need to jump forward a minute, please do.
What do we have to do here?
Nothing. I'm going to take a shower. You sit there and have a drink. Water.
I don't drink. Can I stay on the bar?
No, you must come here now.
I remember thinking at the time, like, his voice was, like, so monstrous and chilling. In that moment, you saw, at least I heard for the first time, what all these other women had talked about.
The most damning portion of the recording comes when Gutierrez asks Weinstein why, the day before, he touched her breasts. And Weinstein says, I'm used to that.
Just come on, I'm used to that.
Are you used to that?
Yes, come in.
No, but I'm not used to that.
I won't do it again.
It was the first time in my producing anything that fear kind of just all of a sudden injected itself into it.
Oh, just hearing that. And, you know, I had already read the book. I'd read the New Yorker stories. I've listened to other podcasts on this topic. I am a true crime podcaster. That's still, like, I could just, bile was just like inching up my esophagus. Ugh. So,
yeah, that was really impactful. Just even hearing it again, it gives you really bad chills. It's just, and that's, yeah, you're right. That's the stuff that's not going to be in the book, even if you listen to the audiobook. It's just, and that's kind of what I thought the podcast was going to be.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's like the thing is in the can. So it's sort of too late for them to redo it. And I certainly am not going to be like, well, Ronan Farrow's podcast is only like a C+. Fuck it. Like, this is a talented person. Mostly,
oh, sure.
I'm just, again, this is disappointing. Like, there were a bunch of ways that this could have been definitely an added value. But, I mean, the book didn't really need value added to it anyway. So this just kind of felt like the publisher was like, well, let's do this. More money for us, more exposure for you. #podcast life. Like, okay, guys.
Yeah, book 2 podcast. I mean, the book was so great. It was definitely one of the best books I've read in a long time. And he really took a challenging story and made it personal. And it just felt suspenseful and interesting. And he was true to, you know, spoke his truth, I guess. You know, he stuck to his guns, and he is the hero of his story, which how often are we the hero of our own story? And he did it so well that I guess maybe after reading the book, I just felt like, okay, this is done. This story has been written. But I think not having a great podcast about your book is a lesser crime. It's not really like a big deal.
This is misdemeanor for sure.
Yeah. It was just like mildly frustrating. I was like, oh man, I really wanted like more catch and kill. Not, you know, it's terrible. It's a sad story, but I was interested in it. And I got kind of like the deleted scenes of the book, which I was fine without.
Yeah, that's an excellent way to put it, on the sort of, and in keeping with the DVD extras metaphor.
Yeah.
I guess what we both wanted was for him to catch and kill someone else, like another story.
Yeah.
So I would rather just see what Farrow is gonna come up with next and read that instead.
Definitely. And I mean, I do appreciate also, like you said, it's a product of the time too. Like when I started reading Catch and Kill, we were not in the age of coronavirus. And when I started listening to the podcast, we were really in the thick of it. So it could be as much my fault as his.
Yeah. Or, you know, he's, as a podcaster, he's an excellent investigative reporter, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
They are different skill sets, and sometimes you just got to try to do something and then it doesn't work. So that's the Catch and Kill podcast with Ronan Farrow. It is available wherever you get podcasts. But if you're trying to decide between that and the book, I got to say, even just the text version, the book, it's really good. Make some time for it, I would say, and skip the podcast. All right, speaking of the hero of our own story, Alex...
In local news today, bees.
Where else can listeners find you and your work?
You can visit my website, alexsegura.com, or follow me on Twitter at alex_segura. And coming up, I've got a Star Wars novel, Poe Dameron Freefall, which will be out August 4th from Disney Books. And The Black Ghost, which collects the first season of my superhero noir comic, is out now from Comixology, which is probably the spot for digital comics.
Awesome. All right, coming up on The Blotter Presents, Toby Ball's back for Wolverine Bad Education. It's not actually called that. We'll talk about it. Kevin Smokler is back with another interview, this time of Criminals Phoebe Judge, and I open BritBox to find Dr. John Watson? Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents, on Twitter and Instagram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Paid subscribers get extra reviews and Blotter briefs, teehee briefs, so sign up today. Today's episode was sponsored by Best Fiends. Download it free wherever you get your apps and games. My guest has been Alex Segura, and he's on Twitter at alex_segura. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.